Welcome to Kidlit Happy Hour. Grab a drink, cozy up,
and explore storytelling with creative minds inside children's publishing and beyond.
How are you? How are you?
I'm doing so well.
You look gorgeous, by the way. It must be known for those who do not see you that your hair is
Re-purple.
It is so purple and it looks beautiful.
I'm like, I'm never going to wash my hair, so it'll just sit like this forever.
I'd encourage you to reconsider that.
Okay, I'm doing awesome. I know I've talked about Books for Maui for the last two shows, but one more thing that is so amazing is I'm going to Hawaii tomorrow. It just so happened that five of the seven organizers for Books for Maui are going to be in Oahu. Only three of them live there, but two of them who live on the mainland happened to be there. And so we were like, we should try to get to, we've never met. Like, long shot. We pitched an idea to Scholastic because they were super generous with their donations. Several of us are Scholastic authors and mentors for their collection. And we were just like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we could all do an event together to talk more about Maui, to raise awareness, to talk about our books, to talk about the collection and the importance of solidarity. And we didn't really think it was going to happen. And then it really did. And Scholastic came through super quickly and set up an event. And we get to all meet in person. I have to say, I felt a lot of guilt because there's so much clear messaging about don't come as a tourist. Mm-hmm. And I was really clear with the group, like, I am your definition of a tourist. I don't have connections to Hawaii. Yeah. And they were like, no, we're inviting you and you're coming to see family. And it's really beautiful. So I'm really excited to see them. So by the time this airs, I'll be back from Hawaii and just probably glowing and happy. I just feel like I have to say thank you to the community who came out so strongly after we tallied all of the donations. There were so many people who didn't win anything and donated anyways, people who won and donated above. And then you add in the Scholastic donation and we raised over $200,000. And that's really the community coming through. So thank you to everyone.
Thank you to all the organizers for making that possible. I cannot wait to hear about the event at Barnes & Noble this weekend. Love that you're all together. How are you outside of going to Hawaii?
I feel like I've been ramping up for the book launch and I've been feeling like about it. I'm just overwhelmed and really wrestling with how to shout about my books without feeling gross about it, without feeling like I'm not doing enough. You know, it's my first book tour. And so I clearly have a lot to learn, but I totally effed up my scheduling and I double booked something. I booked a school visit on the same day I'm supposed to be in Boulder and the visit is in the Bay Area. And I didn't realize, I just like had a total brain fart, didn't put stuff in my calendar and I felt terrible about it and causing like so many people so much stress that was truly on me for not managing my calendar well enough. And so I've been thinking about that, like on a personal note, it's like a strength and a weakness, I think, but I really internalize other people's feelings. And it's something that I'm really trying to work on, not constantly feeling like everything is my fault, especially when people are mad. I don't feel like that all the time, but if I stress people out or upset people or I mess up, then it really sits on me deep. And I have to learn how to own it and then let it go. But that's a process.
It's so hard. Like you're saying, having so many pieces to juggle with the first ever book tour coming up and then taking ownership when we do F up and then also showing self-compassion. Like, this is going to be part of the process right now. This is the learning. This is hard.
It's been a really long time since I've had a feeling like this, but I'm realizing when I was an administrator, I felt like this 10,000 times a day. And that's why I felt so stressed and anxious all the time at my job. Like, no matter how hard you work, people are always upset with you. And no matter how hard you try, you're going to mess up. There are 8 bajillion things that happen in a system that's really not built for people to be successful in an equitable way, at least. I'm sorry, this is like a total overshare, but like, that's my own internal processing about why being an administrator was so hard and my own personal growth as a human. And like, where
can I just name though something down like, something different than you're saying now than what you were saying last year when you were in it, is I'm hearing you be able to verbalize, this is a system that is not set up for people to succeed. Yeah. Whereas back then there was a lot of conversation around like, God, I'm uniquely bad at this. Or I can't hang. And I was watching like, systems really crash on top of you. Yeah. Hold yourself to such a high standard. So I'm grateful that you're at least able to recognize all those pieces.
I feel like I can recognize it in my head now, but like it's my body feels it. Like I feel like I own it all. I don't know how to draw the line of, this is mine to own. This is everyone else's to own, or this is someone else's to own. I just internalize it all. I left because I wanted to write, but I also left because it was incredibly hard for me. And I wish that I could be someone who was like, nope, that's yours. You know, like, no, this is how we're doing it. And I just, sometimes that's the kind of leader you need. And I'm just not that leader yet, you know?
Okay, yet. And also, I think you are that leader. I'm not going to put you on this video. That's
my mind. Totally. We're trying something new this week, folks. We're going bookish and then we're totally not.
So true.
How about you, Caroline? How are you?
Oh, I'm good. Yeah, I'll share something that happened yesterday that is not directly related to my books, which was so helpful to process with you after. But I am like a full-on recluse and I it's just the reality. And if anyone comes near our house, wherever we live, like knocks on the door, I'll hide. I really do. And so I heard a banging at the front door and I hid. And then I realized like it was a frantic banging. So I went to go check and it was my neighbor who I met really briefly once months ago. And she was in a real panic. Her two-year-old had been playing hide and seek and locked himself into the bathroom downstairs. Terrifying. She was terrified. She is on the phone with 911. She was asking me if I knew how to pick a lock. So I'm sprinting over to her house. I've never been there before. I'm now going to teach myself how to pick locks. It's a real skill because I could not figure this out. And it turns out that despite her pleading with the dispatcher, they quite literally said good luck and call a locksmith. They were not going to send someone out. And so she just kind of staring like, what do I do? This poor child just screaming and crying, little two-year-old. And so I'm witnessing all this, trying to get him out and just watching this woman who I don't even know in her home that I've never walked in.
Yeah.
Watch the way that she collected herself and centered her breath and just focused every bit of that tense energy towards this child through this locked door. And as it turns out, he had a stack of books by the toilet. And she said to him, Habibi, grab a book for me. What book did you pick? And this boy who was screaming seconds before, like... collecting himself and was able to, you know, the dinosaur book. And she just got on her knees and pressed her head up against the door and just walked this boy through this story that they had memorized together. And it was the first time you could hear quiet in the home and you could feel connection. And it was just such a stunning moment. And in the meantime, I was able to call 911. And the part that really is killing me is that her first language is Arabic. And my first language is English. And when I called, within 5 minutes of me saying there needs to be a fire department here, this is an emergency, there was a fire truck pulling up to the house.
Yeah.
And you can't help, but there's a real clear path from A to B. And so just sitting with that and the disgust and the horror and the shame I felt from the whole situation. It's a happy ending, which is that these four firefighters came in. This kid happens to love firefighters. Oh. So it took them forever to open the door, but he got out and... they were lovely. They were so well trained for this moment. They were gentle with him and gave him their firefighter hat and they posed for photos with him. He was just delighted. This potentially traumatic moment turned into something that I think will be a beautiful crystal memory for him. Yeah. But I called you right away and I was processing the beauty of this woman, you know, this ability to do this. And you had suggested this is one other thing on my mind. You're like, you should share that story. And I think my fear in sharing it is that it would become a story of like, look at this white woman who came
today.
when I did quite literally nothing she hadn't already done.
Yeah.
Just with an unaccented voice. And just sitting with that reality has been really and just horrifying.
Well, there's multiple things that stand out in that story. I'm so glad you shared it, by the way. And one, I feel like you are so aware of your positionality and your privilege as a white woman. And it makes you deeply uncomfortable, but you use it. And I also love that you were so conscious, like you need to send the firemen, fire people, not the police. Yeah. And that you're conscious of that too, because who knows what happened when police came and there were screaming women and children and who knows. But that you use that the way that I think co-conspirators should be using their privilege. And I know that it makes you deeply uncomfortable and you're not trying to be the hero in this story, but I just want to say that. And I love the story of the mom and how many times have we as moms had to be like the miracles that we have to work in such situations. Like they happen all the time and it's beautiful. And that she came to ask for help. Like, I think that's beautiful. Ugh. And I think the last part of this, which will tie back to bookish things, is that it was ultimately children's books that helped him to calm down, and that there was a instant connection, that there's something shared that's created. There are so many things that stood out both on the disgust level and on the beautiful level, and just the work that we do is really important. And it shows up in so many ways beyond some of the ways that we think about more consciously.
Well, sure. That is a really generous read, and I thank you for that. But yes, the takeaway was exactly what you just said, which was just that woman on every level. I mean, even including the fact that I got to witness her calling her boss because she was missing a meeting.
Yeah.
And the way that she said, "Hi, I will be missing the meeting. I'm not sure if a backup will be there. Thank you." Up the phone, unapologetically. There was so much
love that.
I love that her kid heard that. There was just no wavering. But also,
apologizing either.
No apologizing.
What to do?
Yeah, but just the power of stories. And I think I hear two pieces of that. One, like any story that cracks open a kid's heart, any story that gets into their system that can literally stabilize their nervous system.
Yeah.
There is love and truth and power in that. And that to me is everything. Yeah. And it also made me think how having access to stories that will do that for kids all the way through grownups, that's it. Yeah. And the fact that some people are trying to make that impossible, you know, in schools and libraries. That's what kept coming up for me. Like how can you witness a moment of such truth and beauty and love and connection and not just want more of that for everyone and whatever story speaks to their heart? So yeah, just one of those moments that you feel in your bones. I felt grateful. I got to witness that between the two of them and got to see his little smile from across the street and wave.
And the fire people.
Yeah. Maybe I won't be so reclusive next time that someone else
comes. Stop hiding. But the moral of the story is don't hide when somebody rings your doorbell.
Listen,
because I know you actually hid. You like ran behind a couch or something.
okay, this was a lot of me and you.
Okay,
what are we doing here today?
Yeah, I'm super excited to bring in Michelle Lee, the Very Asian Foundation, who's also a news anchor.
And also, as a reminder, every few episodes, we're inviting folks that aren't directly related to the children's literature publishing industry to share wisdom from their own fields and expertise. And that's because, you know, storytelling happens everywhere. And we're hoping this is just one way we can push back against our own silos and soak up as much wisdom and learning as we can.
And we will just, again, let her take it away because she's brilliant. So enjoy.
Enjoy.
Thank you so much for doing this. I am so excited.
Thank you for having me. You know, I feel like I know you because I stalk you. And then on top of that, you know, we read your book. We buy your books for so many schools. It's always the book people want us to read when we do school events.
Okay, Michelle, since we are officially at a virtual happy hour, we have to start by asking you, what are you drinking today?
Well, I'm drinking water in a very Asian canister that I bought myself. I'm trying to always stay hydrated these days. So I'm trying to stay hydrated. I'm trying to stay calm. But for some reason, aside from water, I have constant cravings for margaritas. It's really strange. I mean, I'm not a margarita type person. Like, I don't go out and go, oh, let's have margaritas. In fact, I very rarely drink. With the exception, okay, I do like Moscow Mules. I do like vodka tonics. I'm not starting off well. But in general, I'm not like a marg kind of person. Sure. But like lately, I've just been like, ooh, margarita sounds so good.
So good.
So good. But that's really water, everyday water.
I'm like, I'm not really a pina colada kind of person, but I also drink pina coladas every time I get a chance. So maybe a pina colada gal.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes when you're like, oh, that is happening with some frequency. Okay.
To readjust my
life.
Okay, well, we started off with drink, but let's introduce, for those who don't know, the esteemed Michelle. We'll do just a quick introduction of how amazing Michelle Lee. So Michelle is a news anchor and reporter, KSDK, which is an NBC affiliate. Her reporting has been honored with a National Peabody Award, 4 National Murrows, and multiple regional Emmys. Holy cow, that's a ton of awards. Often for covering topics related to race or gender inequities, her work is everywhere, including CNN, NBC, CBS, ABC, The Washington Post. And you may also remember Michelle's viral response to a racist voicemail, which became a global movement and has resulted not only in a large donation from The Ellen Show, which became seed money, to create the Very Asian Foundation. I've got my Very Asian hoodie on and Michelle has a Very Asian drinking mug, which focuses on shining a light on Asian culture, voices, and people through advocacy and celebration. We are so honored to have you with us. And for the listeners who don't know the story, could you just share with us what happened with your viral video that blew up?
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, thank you for that nice intro and reading my bio. I'm like this. I'm like, you know, I always say the truth is somebody's got to win every year. Like, that's just how that works, you know? So I'm just really honored that I get to do this for a living. But okay, the viral moment was January 2022. I've lost track of time. And basically, I was just working on New Year's Day. I had just moved to St. Louis to be closer to family and had been in the market like 6 months when I talked about what Americans eat on New Year's Day and why. And so it was like greens for wealth, pork for progress. And then it was a 20-second, what we call 20-second reader. It didn't even have video. It just had like a full screen. And I said, and I had dumpling soup because that's what a lot of Korean people do. Moving on, you know, and then just did like the next story. And so I had a couple of really nice responses, including, I remember a guy in St. Louis, his name is Jim. And he said, hey, my wife was born in Korea and grew up in Korea and our daughter's making that soup for the very first time. So just thanks for the shout out. Like, it was so cool.
Right.
And I'm guessing Jim's not Korean, just by the way he described the situation. And so I was like, oh, here's a St. Louis guy, you know, like saying, ah, he loves it. And I actually shared that. I was like, how cool is it that this know-nothing story was like an inclusive moment for Jim, you know, in St. Louis. But literally, like, I ate my words because a couple hours later, we had a voicemail come through the email system, which I hate, by the way, because back in the day, if someone's going to leave you a nasty voicemail, it would just be to your phone. No, it's like electronic form goes out to an email blast, you know, and you're like, oh, God. But this woman called and said, you know, your Asian anchor talked about what Asian people eat. And I kind of take offense to it because what if a white person said that? They would be fired. She was just being very Asian. She needs to keep her Korean to herself. She needs to talk about what white people eat. I mean, it just went on. And
dang, you have such a nice sounding tone, Shelby. When I listened to it, I was like, I got all, you know.
She sounded awful. Yeah.
Well, but you know what's so funny is that she actually sounded like someone I feel like I could have known, like I could have seen in the pickup line at school.
Yeah.
And I always think it's so incredible when people take the time to do anything nice or bad, you know, to take the effort and energy to look up the phone number, to have the courage, bad or good, you know, to make the phone call and then to leave a voicemail. I mean, it's always like, oh, okay. But to me, she sounded like someone I could have easily, you know, like said hi to or something, or maybe you've known. And anyway, so I basically played that voicemail. It's still on my Instagram and pinned, but I played that voicemail and just me listening to it, drinking my water. And it went viral. And I would not wish that on anybody.
Right.
Because I think that there are a few things that we all think of, like, what if I went viral? What if I won the lottery? What if I was really a princess and no one told me or something? Like, you kind of have these silly scenarios in your head and then you go viral and you're like, that was not at all what I thought that was going to be. And that was very scary. It was terrifying to go viral because things were coming in at an insane speed, you know, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and then text, email, personal email. And it was, everything felt like you had to answer right away. Like, hi, I'm from the Washington Post. Hi, I'm from CNN. Hi, I'm from so-and-so. And then you're dealing also with your boss thinking, is today the day I get fired? Did I mess up? Did I take it too far? Am I going to be unemployed? And then you think, oh my gosh, how many times did I put my kiddo out there? Is someone going to go back 10 years of my Twitter tweets and see something that they don't like and cancel me? It just felt like a lot of anxiety. And I just can't explain what that feeling is like. I think it's going to take me years to kind of figure that out. It was scary, though.
It sounds like a flood, just a flood of inputs all at once.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's amazing. And you galvanize all of those emotions, though, and that experience, and this beautiful thing you created with the Very Asian Foundation. Again, rocket free. But you know, you're donating books and you're doing all this community advocacy, and it's so visible and just so unabashed. And it's beautiful to see so publicly how you took this really painful moment and then the super overwhelming thing and then turn in something that would really support this community. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, you're really so kind to say that. I think at the end of the day, I think all of us, if we had a chance, you have to make a decision. How am I going to meet a moment? Yeah. And can I use the skills that I have and the work that I've done previously that maybe no one knew about to continue work in a different way? And so that's been really incredible, but I certainly am not alone. I mean, we have our wonderful executive director, her name's Suji Hong. Gia Vang is also the other co-founder. We have a ton of people who come in and out, you know, in terms of volunteering. So that's been really special, but I still have a lot of like FOMO. I have a lot of imposter syndrome. There are things that I think also that have heightened like anxious thoughts too, you know, where I'm like, how can we sustain this? Or will anyone care about this movement in 6 months? You know, all those things. It's just, it's really, I mean, maybe as an author, you feel that too. I don't know. Like maybe it's just as a person, you feel that too sometimes. Absolutely. But yeah.
Sure. When I started writing, you know, my passion has always been in like anti-racist, anti-bias education. And then now in storytelling, for example, my novel, The Silence That Binds Us, I wanted to write a story about anti-Asian racism and Black and Asian solidarity. And I started it in, you know, like 2017, which is way before the pandemic, before Stop Asian Hate was a hashtag, but it came out just last year. And so it felt like people were like, oh, this is so timely. I'm like, no, I wrote this multiple years ago. And I'm very aware that just a couple years ago, speaking about anti-Asian racism was not even a thing. Like no one believed it was real. And I'm very aware, like, how long does this moment, how long do people care about our stories? We just talked about this the other day, I think, we're just constantly like, is this the last book that anyone's ever read? Is this it? How long do we get to hang on to this moment when people are listening?
Oh, I mean, I hate it. But at the same time, I'm glad that you said that because I feel that so deeply, you know, and also because people are already, I think as groups get bigger and as they're doing more things, people are definitely getting more siloed already. Yes. And sometimes it's really wonderful to see the general uplifting, but also it's like, oh, am I going to get invited to this? Should I get invited to this? Do I want to get invited to that? You know, and then you're really like, I don't want to go to anything. I don't want to sit in my jammies at home. And so sometimes I feel like, oh, I also have to step away because this is not real life. You know, like these big events are not real life or
it's not actually the work. It's like a very public, beautiful faith. I'm not invited to those things, but I have an idea. I see them.
I've been to a couple.
But I think I'm aware of like, how do we maintain cohesiveness as a community? Whatever community for us, like as Asian Americans or whatever the community is, as you try to uplift, how do you also maintain solidarity as people have different ideas of what doing the work, you know,
And I think as like women, we still have so much work to do collectively. And then also as moms, I still feel so much inequity in all my spaces, you know, and it's not that anyone's trying to maliciously turn on moms. It's just that sometimes the work is better suited for people who don't have to be primary caregivers, you know? So it's like, to me, I'm like, well, I can travel twice this month out of state, but what does that look like for my son when I come back? Or I'm doing so much work front facing, but what work am I doing in my home for my marriage, for the sanctity of like our family? And then sometimes I said this analogy to my executive director because we had to edit a video together. And she was like, is there any way that I can make this process easier on you? Because it has to be done basically like last week. And I was like, listen, here's the thing. There are no shortcuts to editing video. Like it just has to get done. It's going to take me probably 5 hours to put this together. Just like you can't build muscles overnight. Like this, you just have to do the work. This is why I also don't have muscles. So, you know, but it's like, you know what I mean? Where am I going to steal this 5 hours from when I'm already working around the clock? And so I always feel like, gosh, you look around the world and you go, okay, well, who's doing the work? Who's making things turn? I always say moms can get the job done, but at the same time, at what cost, you know? And it's just, it's really hard, I think.
Ooh. Yeah. Totally. Humaning.
Yeah.
You know, and mommying.
Humaning. Yeah. I love that. Yeah.
World changing. Okay. I know we sort of started off this way, but I want to sort of shift us into this idea of story. Mm. So especially in this context, you have a foundation. You are a mom. You are also a news anchor. Like you do 8 bajillion things. In your mind, within all these contexts, Can we just start at the very basics? What is a story to you? Like, what does that mean?
Well, so in news terms, like as a journalist, when I look at a story, I look at what is the relevance of the story. And so you can always make a case for relevance in any form or fashion. But I have to think of stories in a really different way. Sometimes it's like a 20-second story. It's a 30-second story. It's a minute 15. How much can we cram in here? What is the relevance of it? What's the impact? And that's why sometimes we have a real clashing of opinions on what makes a good story. When you're working in a forum like television, you need audio and visuals. And so many of the good stories, I think, don't have good audio or visuals. Some of the meatier stories and the more important stories when you're talking about bans or you're talking about gender-affirming healthcare or things that are happening in the state legislature. Those are not what we call sexy stories in terms of video. Right. We do have a term called BOPSA. I don't know if the kids use it, but, you know, we used to say like, ah, oh, it's just a bunch of BOPSA video. Bunch of people sitting around. You know, it's hard. It's hard to watch a bunch of people sitting around on video. Anyway. What I'm trying to say is I feel like a good story always has a beginning, middle, and an end, a central character, a theme, a thesis, even if it's a 20-second story. Mm-hmm. But for me, in my mind, if I'm going to get this pitched and through my assignment desk and my managers, what's the relevance? Why? We always ask this. Why do we care? Why does anybody care? Mm-hmm. I hate it because sometimes I'm like, well, why does it matter who cares? But those are kind of the criteria I live by on a daily basis.
I have so many questions.
Okay.
One of them is just, so in something that's a quote unquote sexy story, like book video, mm-hmm. how do you take that? And because those are relevant and they're important, obviously, I think they are.
Sure.
But how do you do something like that when you don't have the video or the audio, but the story itself is incredibly important?
Those, they get a pass because they are such big issues across the country. So we'll do it whether it's a bunch of BOPSA video or not. At the frequency at which book bans are happening across the state of Missouri or, you know, a lot of states, it's really hard to cover because sometimes schools don't want to talk because they don't want to bring attention to the books that they're getting. So really, then you just have politicians speaking. Well, what are the politicians saying? These are the politicians that are probably banning the books, you know? So you do have to really be careful on how you're balancing a story. And then some of these stories require more depth journalism. And so sometimes it's hard to do what you really want to do in the in the 6 hours that you're given to turn a story. Right. So we cover stories, whether they are visually compelling or not, but some stories that lend themselves to really great sound or video opportunities get a pass because it's like, oh, it's going to be great video. And that is also what has harmed television news over years because it's like, oh, but that's great fire video. So it's like a lot of crime scenes get shown more often because it grabs your attention.
You talked a lot about how a story has to have relevance. Question for you is, in your opinion, as a professional journalist, what's the responsibility of news to make people care about issues they don't know about, that they don't know are relevant?
That's a great question. And I think that really boils down to the importance of representation in your newsroom, right? So I'll just use me as an example. I'm the first East Asian anchor that St. Louis has seen since the beginning of broadcast. I mean, there have been East Asian anchors, let me say this, in St. Louis, but I'm talking about Monday through Friday, where we were promoting you as a main anchor, which I think is pretty incredible. No, but the interesting thing is this happens to so many Asian Americans. People don't even realize. I've been in the industry for 20 years, and I've been the first or the only in every market that I've been in. In some form or fashion, right? So like in Seattle, there were lots of Asian people, but you could be like, I'm the first adoptee in this circle, or I'm the, you know, and it also shows you the vast underrepresentation in all of our markets. I think the Asian American Journalists Association did a brief overview and they looked at the top 20 markets and found that the Asian Americans are largely underrepresented in the biggest cities where the most Asian Americans live. So there are 200 markets across the country. So if it's not happening in the top 20, it's also not happening in any of them.
Right.
But that's why I think representation is important, no matter who you are, right? Like there used to be no women in the newsroom, right? And we're still paying for that. because you can work in a newsroom and not have a wellness room of your own or things like that. So then you might not think like that's an important story to cover, like women in the workplace trying to get equity across the board, whether it might be in terms of motherhood or maternity leave or paternity leave, any kind of parent leave. In newsrooms, they don't necessarily provide the best mental health spaces because a lot of times the topics are toxic. You're dealing with people on the best days of their lives and the worst days of their lives, you know? And like for me, I had gun violence in my family. And so you have that empathy when you go to a scene, or you have the empathy to tell a story that maybe no one has heard. Maybe it's about mental health. Maybe it's about suicide. Maybe it's about all these other things. We all bring our own experiences to the table so that we can understand stories a little bit better. Now, in the past, people used to say things like, oh, you're too close to that story, so I don't think you can do it. And I think now there's more of a conversation of, you have experience understanding this issue better at a deeper level. And so you should cover that if you want to. I think that that's the shift that we're seeing. And I think that that is really important. So going again, a little long-winded, representation really does matter so that you can get more stories brought to light. We always say journalists shine a light on the good and the bad. And really that's when you have the opportunity to shine a light on something, then I think more people do care, you know. And I always tell, especially young journalists too, you don't have to throw a million facts at the audience. People won't remember the fact, but they will remember how they feel when they see your story. They'll remember the mother, the father, whoever it is, you know. That's why television or audio can be so powerful, or any story, because it's like when you feel something, then you do something. We used to say you learn something, you feel something, you do something. And I think that that's so important. But yeah, that's why representation matters in all forms.
We are so thrilled to finally bring this podcast to life, which means we are now aware of all the costs that go into it, like recording and hosting platforms, sound editing, and goofy microphones and more. So we've started a Patreon to help cover costs. To anyone who signs up for our Patreon this month, we're offering a $15 thank you gift to JK Chocolate, home of the world's most delicious, addictive, irresistible microchip cookies. They are freaking delicious. I gift them to literally everyone, including my publishing team and my agent. And for the first 20 friends that sign up for the top membership tier, we will also send you your very own jar as a thank you for your support. Check it out at patreon.com/kidlithappyhourpodcast.
It's so beautiful. And I feel like, especially with how you introduce the virality of your video, so pertinent, this idea of, we have this responsibility to show the relevance of a story and making sure there's representation in the newsroom to make it relevant. But you're doing all of that in a world where you simply have 20 seconds talking about the food you eat and someone responds like, identity politics.
Yeah.
Like, how dare she, right? So the reality is we live in this heinously polarizing world where you standing in front of a camera and speaking your truth can be perceived as such an attack on someone's whiteness and where they in the space they've taken for so long. And so you were starting to describe in storytelling, it's not just the right person being able to be the one to tell the story. It's how you communicate that story.
Sure.
I think about that a lot too, in terms of writing in the kidlit world. We've established how important it is that you're the person to tell your own story. How do you show the humanity, like you were saying, make it about the mother, the child, and not just about something that might be perceived as didactic to the consumer.
Oh, sure. And, you know, and that's really hard too, because there are lots of stories that I've told over the years. I mean, you do one or two stories a day for 20 years. No. You know, you're obviously not going to be able to have those lived experiences, you know, with all the people that you cover. And now there's so much care and consideration. And I don't want to seem like I'm coming in and telling your story for you.
Yeah.
Tell me what I need to know. Tell me what people need to know. How do I present this in a way that's respectful to you, but also allows me to get my job done? We used to say this, and I still sort of agree with it. But, you know, sometimes, this is so hard to even say, but sometimes the stories that you tell about people are not for them. They're for other people. They're for other people to understand. And so sometimes that's a really hard line to walk because people will want you to tell their story in the way that they want to. And sometimes that's not the truth, or sometimes that's not what's going to serve the greater purpose of the story. So that's difficult. But I always feel like if you let people speak their truth and you are just the venue to weave it in together, then you can't go wrong, ideally. But for me, when I'm working on deadlines, and again, working sometimes with people on their worst days of their lives, you know, sometimes there are ethical decisions. People might tell you everything, and then they'll call you and they'll say, I really don't want you to share that. And so, and that's happened to me before. And as a journalist, it's really hard because once the bell's been rung, it's really hard to unring it. And if someone tells me something and it's like, well, at this point, though, you've kind of already released it. So those are kind of different experiences as a journalist, you know. And the truth is, I'm not a PR machine for people. I have a different role to play in storytelling. We always say we're the first draft of history. So that's kind of my role. But it's hard. It's really hard. Sometimes ethics really do play a role in it. And then if someone's in danger, of course, you know, we make those decisions. Sometimes people put you in between a rock and a hard place.
Can you say more about what you mean by serving the purpose of the story?
Oh, sure. I mean, we've got to get the story out. Not necessarily an agenda. Sorry, I don't know if that came across like an agenda.
Well, I'm just going to like dig deeper to understand.
Well, there have definitely been times where people have shared something and talked about something and didn't want to say that, you know? And so then you have to really think, but this is a key element to the story, or this is a very important part of the story that I don't think we can leave out. This is why we interviewed you. And now you're getting scared that your neighbors might find out that you have this thing going on in your life. I don't ever want to do harm in any of my stories, but those are just fine lines that you have to walk constantly and always want to be ethical and leave people feeling good about a story, you know, having integrity in the story.
I'm struck by how many tensions there are as a journalist.
Yes.
That you have to navigate. So this idea of gathering the stories, gaining trust, and then also you're not the PR machine. You're not there to be their therapist. You're there to report on a story. I love this phrase that you're the first chef of history. And then I'm struck by you're also gatekeepers of history. Yeah. Then so that representation matters even more because a diverse perspective of history is important. And the way that we view the things that we learn are obviously influenced by.
Yeah. And we're all human. And that's why attribution is so important. Because if I'm thinking of like a criminal story, right? Crime story, right? Where you cover someone has been accused of murder. They do the trial, they go to jail. And literally, I mean, this just happened in St. Louis. 30 years later, they were found innocent. And so 30 years later, DNA evidence comes out. 30 years later, witnesses say they felt coerced into saying things. So that's why you can only share the truth as you know it when you're telling a story and making sure that you, as the voice, are not saying, this is what happened. This is what people say happened. So it's hard. It's just really hard. Most of the time, my stories are like, hey, this is a good way to save money. So at least there's a silver lining there. But there are times when it's really difficult or when you're dealing with politicians sometimes. I mean, there's just all kinds of things you got to think about.
The other tension I'm thinking about is it's a capitalist system. Like you're a news organization, a public works, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's also for making money. You need people to watch the stories. And I'm thinking about this personally, too, as an author. But in a capitalist system where even the news bends towards making money and gaining viewership, plus all these other tensions that you've just explained, how do you stick to those values and your integrity?
Oh, sure. I should say, you know, it comes down to ratings. So like if your ratings, if you're number one, then it's like then you set the price for your advertisements. And so I don't ever have to deal with that. It's just like this. This is a good story. This is what we want to do. We think this is promotable because we always have to have promotables or whatever. And so we can stay news focused. But I will say there was one time many, many years ago, I was working with an investigative reporter and she did a consumer piece. I mean, it really wasn't that special. But at the end of the day, the story was like, you know, should you buy a used car or a new car? You know, but she ran numbers and did all these things. But basically, at the end of the day, it was like, you should never buy a new car, which is nothing new. But the sales team was so upset. This is not in St. Louis. This is another station. because all of the dealerships pulled their advertising. So there are things that are real consequences from stories. I think people do, like management level, probably think, okay, is this going to get us in trouble? Let's make sure we are 100% sure that we want to air the story. I remember she was like, well, the boss of the entire station said, we just lost $1 million worth of advertising. And he's wondering why I should keep my job when I'm making $30,000. And I was like, oh, that sounds so icky. I don't want to be in that position at all.
I wonder about, though, for you too, Michelle, you're in this intersection, right? As Joanna was naming earlier, of collecting stories, making sense of them, determining the purpose, figuring out how to weave them into something that's cohesive for someone without the context. And because we live in the world that we're in about what is clickable and what's not. And of course, I imagine as a journalist, you're trying to tell a story in a way that's finding the heartbeat and making it compelling while also generating eyeballs, right? To this important storytelling. Do you find yourself in the role that you're in kind of tugging between like what is truth versus sensationalism? What is the way to best honor and tell the story?
Yeah. So in my mind, I don't think of it as being sensational, but I definitely have learned over years, what is the teasable factor, right? And how far can you take it without crossing a line? You know, I mean, that part is business where you're like, okay, what's the catchiest headline, but that still holds true. And sometimes, you know, sometimes they're wins and sometimes they're major fails, you know, and it's hard because especially if it's a deadline driven story where it's like, you've got to turn it, then you're doing all this stuff turnkey very quickly and you want to be right. But you're always asking yourself, what's the nugget of this story? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not ever in a mindset where I'm like a business person, but I know that my producers will want the line that is the catchiest so that people will be, because so many people are passive viewers. I mean, it's hard to capture more people's attention because also people want to be in their silos. So they don't want to be out of their comfort zone. They want to kind of reinforce that they're right. And that's a big challenge with local news, I think, especially with some of the things that we faced. You know, I used to be like really fun to be a journalist. Now it's like, oh, you're fake news. You know, like all these other things that you're like, oh my gosh, why have I invested in this career?
I think it's really similar for educators and authors at this point.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Sometimes, and you know what? And you don't get paid enough to take so much abuse. Mm-hmm. I remember there were times when I was in my 20s covering teacher protests. And I would say, can I ask how much you're making? You know, like everyone wanted raises. And I remember at one point, a teacher was like, I'm making $40,000 a year. And they were really upset by it. And I was like, oh my God. Because I was making $28,000, you know? Oh my God. And I was like, oh, those can be true. We both needed raises, you know? But you do get so much abuse sometimes from the public and from people, so much distrust and some of the conspiracy theories. And no, it's really just as simple as I live in this community and I'm writing stories about this community, you know?
What keeps you in it? Keeps you doing it despite all?
I really love it. I'm telling you like the worst of it, right? But in general, I go into work. I really love the people I work with, especially my co-anchor, Rennie Knott. If you ever Google him, he's insanely kind and generous. We have a very quirky and smart and fun team. And that to me, I don't know if anyone would ever say this, but for us to have that kind of friendship captured at work is really special because I've worked with a lot of ding-dongs, you know, a lot of egomaniac ding-dongs, but I like it. So I really like my job. And most of the time, your stories are just your stories. They're stories about money or they're stories about people doing amazing things in the community that you would never read somewhere else, you know? So most of the time they're important, you know, but not like chasing down someone during a perp walk, which I've done, you know, most of the time I'm not dealing with that. So that's good. But there are hard stories for sure.
Yeah. What are the ones that you had mentioned, stories that people might not otherwise hear? Like, what are the stories that drive you when you think about your purpose as a journalist?
Well, one story that was really important to me, this was probably 2015. There was a story of a woman who was a Korean immigrant who had two sons. They were transgender sons. And it was really, I think, such an important story at the time, because at that time, there weren't a lot of stories about transgender families and about immigrants who are trying to understand their transgender families. And also, it was a little unique to maybe have two siblings who were transgender. But unfortunately, the hardest part of the story was that the youngest son completed a suicide plan. And in a way that was very public in our city, not in St. Louis, but in another city. And it really devastated the entire family. And the mother went from being extremely ashamed to becoming this pretty big advocate for the community. The problem is that there was so much damage between her surviving son and the rest of the family that it really was a hard story to do. But I felt like it brought so much to light about what children are going mm-hmm. through, teenagers are going through. There's so much grief and loss before, you know, the son was gone. So I just think those kinds of stories, while terribly sad, can be so powerful about the way people see each other and treat each other. And so stories like that also have changed me, you know, over time. Like, oh, I don't understand because I don't live in your shoes, but I have right. so much empathy and I want to support you and tell me how, you know, you learn better language, you live in the world a little differently. And I think that those kinds of stories are really important. And again, when we talk about relevance, it's really hard to maybe pitch that as a day turn kind right. of story. But to me, the relevance was this is happening in our community and we need to save children. We need to save their lives, you know, so that they are here for their own self-discovery and also give resources to families. So so that's, again, about the representation, I think.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, that was kind of a heavy story, but.
No, that was beautiful. I hope bring to light all of the things you've been talking about in terms of your own passion and the importance of story to begin with. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks.
Joe, can I ask one more before we... Okay. Michelle, a good chunk of our viewers are going to be folks in the space writing for children.
Okay.
And I'm curious, you know, with the career that you've spent hunting down and piecing together and exploring story and knowing that you're hemmed in by truth in a very literal way, I'm curious if you have any thoughts or ideas for writers in terms of how to find the heartbeat of a story. And how to really hone in on the nugget, as you describe, especially knowing that folks have more leeway in how we tell stories when we're not hemmed in by reality a bit.
Well, I mean, hours. I just think it's like at the end of the day, what do you want people to leave with? You know, when we used to do storytelling workshops, I mean, they still have them in journalism. And it's always really important for me if I'm really struggling to write a thesis. And the thesis, though, is really just like subject, verb, action. Like that's it, you know, feeling. And sometimes that helps me, like, okay, this is going to be the focus. And it could be something as mom is upset that this happened. But I also think, how are you going to pitch things later? What's the hook? That always helps, I think, sometimes hone in on a focus. But in general, I always feel like just writing from the heart is so important. And everything else kind of falls into place that way. But I think if you're ever lost, it's always like, well, what's the real motion here? Who is it impacting and why is it important? You know, but like I struggle with that too. So I'm not on it all the time. We just do our best. Okay.
Yeah. I thought picture books were hard with 500 words and you're describing a whole story in 20 seconds
with visual and audio. Probably like 1 hour to research.
I know. And it's always like, you know, tell this to me in a sixth grade level, but make it smart, make it memorable, make it all these things. And sometimes I think this is just impossible for people in any situation, you know? So it's like, you can't really win, but we can do our best.
Totally.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Thank you so much. This was incredible. There are just so many connections, I think.
Oh, well,
just storytelling in general that are so powerful that I can't wait to keep thinking about.
Well, I wish I could do what you did. You know, you do. You know, to me, it's like I can tell facts. I can find an emotion. I can put it together. But I'm just really blown away by people who can write intelligently for children, you know, in a beautiful kind of way. I feel like that's such a gift and talent and craft. And I'm really blown away by that.
Thanks. We're also here trying to continue learning how to do that because I think we're all trying to figure it out. But we always close with an overshare. It's happy hour. And this overshare is hopefully something juicy related to your career, however you want to define it. You know, it could be silly or goofy or funny or embarrassing or heartfelt or serious or, you know,
You would be surprised at how many people hook up in newsrooms. So I is that juicy enough?
It's right over here.
It's like right over here. I think that's how I met my husband, who's in the other room, probably listening to me right now. So he was a photographer. I was a reporter. We would go out on stories, and eventually, you know, they would become like mini dates every day. So we would go out on a story together, and then we'd be like, okay, you want to get lunch?
So great.
But lots of people end up getting, you know, getting together in newsrooms and then doing other things.
Multiple stories being written.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Thank you for sharing. I'm like, there's so many possibilities for YA novels that I'm thinking about. Filters is a book that is about, I think it's that one that's about two journalists. I think there's a, they're high school journalists though.
Was making me think of The Morning Show, which is not for children.
I know.
Shows like, oh, is that true? There really is all the intermingling.
I mean, there is a lot of intermingling. And actually, so I knew some people who at the time had thought that it was about one particular show on TV. Sure. And so they're like, oh, yeah, that's how that happened. Or that's how that happened. People were texting and I was like, oh, gosh.
Totally.
But I only watched the first season, so I couldn't tell you anything beyond that.
I've never seen it. Now I feel like I should go back and do it.
Yeah. Michelle, is there any way for folks that are just coming to learn about you and your work that we could follow along or support you?
Oh, you're so kind. I think everything I post is on social, even though sometimes for my mental health, I need to back away from social. So Michelle Lee TV is my handle on most places. VeryAsianFoundation.org is our website, or my day job is KSDK. So anything on KSDK.com or anything on social there.
And also, because people can't see, it's M-I-C-H-E-L-L-E-L.
Yes, L-I. That's a whole other story, but yes, L-I.
Okay. Thank you again so much. It was so nice to chat and learn from you today.
Oh my gosh, thank you. I learned so much. Thank you very much for having me.
If you enjoy this podcast, we would be so grateful if you would please take a moment to do any or all of the following things.
Follow or subscribe by tapping on the little plus sign or follow next to Kidlet Happy Hour in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
And while you're there, we would love if you could leave a rating, preferably one with 5 stars, as well as a review.
And don't forget about Patreon, where you can help support production costs, ask us questions, get even more overshares, and receive a delicious thank you treat from JK Chocolate. Check out patreon.com/kidlethappyhourpodcast.
Thank you so much for being here, and we hope to see you back for the next episode.